We are on. Welcome back to another episode of the Hip Hop Social Worker Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Scott. Today, I am joined by the great James Bell, third. We met on Twitter, social media, where we got, one of the few people I got to connect with, like, in person. We were at the Millennial Social Work Conference. And that was before we got locked down. So we're very grateful that we got to do that. And we both presented, and his presentation was great. He's not a therapist, so like I love when I get like people who don't do therapy on this podcast because they get to kind of show like the other side of social work. So I'm gonna let him go ahead and introduce himself. Go ahead, brother.
Hey, Chris, it's a pleasure to be on the show. I've been listening for a while now. As you mentioned, yes, we did actually get to meet, which is a rarity. People become social media friends, but actually we had the chance to share space, which is like unheard of, especially in like this current COVID situation. So that was pretty dope. And also, shout out to the Millennial Social Worker Conference, because that was actually my first time hearing about it. But to actually be there and be amongst other young social workers who want to make a difference in people's lives, like there's a lot of energy there, and I really like that. So kudos to all of them. And also I just saw that there are accepting proposals for next year, so people listening, please get out there. About me, I am originally from the city of Detroit. I was born and raised in the city of Detroit. I get offended when people say they're from Detroit, but they're actually from the suburbs. I went to Detroit public schools, so I'm through and through. And I went to Michigan State University for my bachelor's and for my master's. And it was interesting that I ended up in social work because I wanted to be a psychologist. And I think this is a lot of people's kind of track. You go, you get the psych degree, and like, oh, I can't do much with a bachelor's in psychology. And I started looking into the master's programs and the PhD programs, and it just didn't fit me and what I wanted to do. And I actually had the benefit of having an internship at a community-based organization like the summer before my senior year.
Yeah.
And my first introduction into community organizing, into community outreach, to having a relationship with the community and helping them to drive decision-making. And from that point forward, it's like, what is this? This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And finding out what macro versus micro social work was, it's like, okay, I know me personally, I'm not good with people and their feelings, never have been. If you're crying across from me, the best I ever can really do is offer you a tissue until you buckle up. So for me, it was really like, yeah, I can get into this community space. So MSU offered a, what did they call it at the time? Organizational community practice macro
concentration.
So that was where I felt most comfortable. I think my is baby girl.
Yeah. Hold on real quick. Let me go ahead and I think our mom is asleep.
Getting exposed to that in social work, it became clear for me that was the path that I wanted to go in. It was actually graduation day with my master's when I got my first job off. Like I was stressing because I'm about to graduate. I got no job on the table. And my first job was with the state human service agency, Child Protective Services, for just over a year. And I felt in that time, I experienced all the things that they talk about with like compassion fatigue and burnout, but it also exposed me to what it's like to have to communicate to different parties and different groups with different interests.
Yeah.
So you go from getting cussed out by a family because you had to make a decision that was, not favorable, to then going and getting reamed out by a judge because you didn't dot the I on your report. And then your supervisor's giving you another case when you just got off the one. And so I knew I did not want to be there that long, but I felt like it was an experience that I needed to have. Kind of shifted from, that more community focus to now working with families. And the next job opportunity I had was actually in policy. And I was like, okay, this kind of makes sense because I've always been a how and why type of person. And it was more in health information technology, which I'm like, I don't know anything about tech like this. But again, it exposed me and gave me skills to kind of pursue a different direction in social work. I know there's groups out there that do social work tech. Shout out to y'all. But I'm not one of them. But it did expose me to facilitation. It exposed me to diversity, equity, inclusion work, which is where I find myself now, like, most excited and most energized. So I stayed at that employer for about 6 years. And just last year, almost a year ago, I returned to state employment. And now I'm working in our public health administration in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's never a boring moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you like get worried when you got your state job the first time and you were like, this ain't what I thought it would be?
Yeah, but I was also greedy. I mean, I was fresh out of grad school. That was the first time I had like overtime, like time and a half. Mm-hmm. That's like, yeah, y'all want me on call? Bet. Because if the phone don't ring, I'm still getting paid. And for me, that was a motivating force because I was young, I was dating, and you know, trying to save up for a wedding ring. So like all of those things kind of facilitated more money for me at that time, which was a motivating force. But I also realized the burden it started to put on me because I just didn't have the energy to do anything else. Mm. It's like you work Monday through Monday and you're just like, I don't want to do this.
Okay.
And the policies.
My bad.
The policies didn't always fall in line. That was always my big issue. Like, are we really supporting families? Like, are we really making things better for folks? Or are we just checking a box? Because that was really frustrating because I have to remove a child because it says X, Y, and Z. This isn't culturally competent. This isn't taking in consideration very specific community dynamics. You're saying that you want the child to be safe, but the foster care system that I was exposing them to, I saw holes in it. And it's like, I have to leave this child here because that's what my job tells me to do. And I couldn't accept that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like that's always like the flip side of like therapy and direct service. It's like, okay, so like, am I doing something like substantial or am I like just checking the box? Because in some, let's say like in some, like, you know, the perfect world, you know what I'm saying? A family has a mishap, boom, they, you know, lose their kids. They have the resources to fix the mishap, and then the kids can come back to the family. You know, like, that's how, you know, that's how it works. Or if you needed therapy, you know what I'm saying, you have all the resources to go to therapy, and you go to therapy, and you can talk it out, and you can still, like, live your life without, you know, any mishaps going on. And then, you know, in about a year or two, you build some skills, and, you know, you're out the door. But what we see generally, especially when we work in public spaces, is like there's so many holes in each system that like us just doing like the direct service part is like we're kind of just like pacifying. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. You know, like in some parts of therapy, like I feel like I'm just teaching you how to just deal with your sucky circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
That could be better if the system was better, but because it's not, I'm just going to go ahead and tell you, hey, man, just breathe through it, bro. You know, like, and sometimes, and sometimes it feels like, ugh, you know, so, you know, like, so the flip side of things is like, yeah, we are, like, you know, therapists and direct service workers are an important part of this, but there's also more that we got to kind of, like, push back on, you know.
And you start to ask yourself why a lot, too. You know, I started paying more attention even when I was doing direct service into who was making the policy. Like I understand that there's certain rules that come from like the national level, but then you start drilling down to what the state has to implement and you start looking at who's in the room. Yeah. There's no person of color in there.
Yeah.
So now you have a policy that's not inclusive. It's not going to be equitable anyway. Mm-hmm. So, that's part of the reason why I'm grateful to be in the spaces that I'm in now. I mean, there's still challenges, but at least now there's a voice in there can say, hey, that shit ain't right. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's going to happen and we're going to perpetuate harm for folks.
Yeah, for sure. So for anybody listening to this, how did you like make the transition from like, you know, direct service to policy? Like you might've like, you touched on it before, but, you know, like, kind of give, like, the nuts and bolts. Like, how did you, like, you know, like, you know, like, did you change your resume to say certain things? Did you, you know, do informational interviews? Like, you know, how that happened?
So one of the benefits when I made the switch, my the field instructor, my second year in my grad program, we always kept in touch. And he was the executive director of our local community mental health agency. Mm-hmm. And he was like, hey, James, there's this opportunity coming up. It's more in the policy space, which I know you're more interested in the OCL side of things anyway. Just throw your name in the hat. And I was kind of like, okay, you know, when people think social work, they all tend to think like the same prototype. Like, I'm a therapist, I'm a caseworker. And so I think we're going to talk about this more later too. I kind of stood out as an African-American male macro social worker. So I'm felt like a unicorn, right? So anybody who could actually create a position that I would be interested in, I knew I was going to be a top candidate. Like, skill set that I brought anyway, in addition to just who I was, there was no way that people were going to tell me no. And so I did start making shifts in my resume to really reflect more of the operations of things. Like, how did I come to start doing X? And the focus really started to broaden then for me. Like, it went from managing a caseload of, you know, 40 families to taking more intention on facilitating those family team meetings. And then representing the organization at these broader networking stakeholder groups. Like, I went from just sitting, you know, family to family to actually going to our more of our like regional state meetings where we're having conversations about child death review. We're having conversations around mandated reporting. And so the actual operations that go on behind the scenes is where I really started to shine. And so I could speak to not only, you know, CPS, but I could also speak to the systems around it. And I think that's what helped me to stand out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense. Cause like, I always think like, you know, like, I don't want to get pigeonholed into direct service, and how do I didn't talk about this before. Like, how do I, you know, branch out to something different, you know? And mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm not the only person that thinks that way. Cause like you said, direct service is hard, you know, capacity fatigue is a real thing. And then dealing with like you said, like, you, like, you know, like when you see the inconsistencies and like say, who's making this policy, you know, say like, why is the policy in place and why is this policy so important that you want me to kind of hold this to the fire, you know what I'm saying? So, all right. So, and how do you like, you know, like, so when did you really like, you know, get into like, okay, this is my thing to do, you know what I'm saying? I'm here to make everything equitable, you know, like when did that happen for you?
So at my last job, they actually host a health equity and social justice workshop series. Let me not say host. It's actually a service that like our health departments, other community organizations use. And I got the opportunity to attend. And so it opened my eyes to these concepts of DEI. And I started paying more attention into how it's applied or how it's allegedly applied. And I just became fascinated with it. And I think it's also a reflection of like the macro in me. I have a strong focus, like a laser focus on institutional problems. Like it's just the first thing I see. I know you think about direct care, you think about individual, you think about interpersonal. My mind jumps immediately to what is the organization doing that's perpetuating inequity? Like that is the first thing that I think of. You know, when groups put out policy statements, the first thing I'm doing, I'm going to their website, I'm looking at their board. I'm looking at their leadership. Like that's just the way that I tend to function. And so for me, the moment I came out of that workshop, I was like, okay, I've got a whole new entree of knowledge that I have to do something about.
Yeah.
And so I had already taken like a few facilitation courses. Like I learned how to run a meeting more or less, how to run a meeting from we have this goal that we want to accomplish. How are we going to get there? How are we going to document our outcomes? What are the objectives? Like I was able to do that. So I was able to put a framework around equity using facilitation.
Mm-hmm.
And once those things combined, I mean, it was pretty much a wrap. So I started doing some of those facilitations for the health equity workshops. I did strategic planning for organizations that wanted to introduce equity principles. It became very attached to just who I was. It was like almost like a second language for me.
Yeah.
Like I can go into just about any room and start applying that equity lens on the problems that we're facing.
Mm. Okay. And I'm always like in awe of people who can do that. Like anybody who can do anything at like just so naturally, it's like, damn, like I'll wait. Like, and that's probably something that I do naturally that people like pick up on, but because I'm doing it, I don't really see it. You know, but I'm always like just like amazed by what people just kind of like get in the room and just maneuver. You know what I'm saying?
So and it's funny because I'm an introverted person. Like I'm very like just kind of to myself, to my family-ish. But when I get in those spaces, it's just like a whole different me.
Yeah. I mean, you do it well. I've seen it. You do it well.
Thank you. Thanks, bro.
How much of your job is like facilitation? You know, are you building decks all the time and presenting information? Or are you like kind of like, are you like really just kind of sitting there listening to like kind of policies and then giving feedback?
I would say the facilitation now is probably about 20% of like my day job. Now I just started a side hustle. I just started my LLC maybe 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think the things was just the insecurity of what was going on with COVID. I had been furloughed. I was like, oh, there's all these things going on. I need to make sure that I protect myself and my family. So I started LLC, which is really driven by facilitation. So that is probably like 90%.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, right now, I think with just our current social climate, it's going to continue to increase. Michigan just produced an executive order where all healthcare professionals need to complete implicit bias training. Ooh. So it's just going to blow up from here.
Yeah, definitely. And you right place, right time, baby.
Yeah. And at the same token, though, I don't want to be, you know, just out there again, checking the boxes. I actually want to see institutional change. I want to see organizations who understand that in this patient-provider relationship, I'm making decisions unconsciously the moment that you walk into the room.
Yeah.
I see you. I see your skin. I might not give you the same treatment that I may give somebody that's white.
Yeah.
Or I might give you additional things. Like, it's just understanding that and then understanding how once you leave the doctor's office, there's all these other systems that you have to engage with. And so if I'm experiencing challenges with transportation, if I'm experiencing challenges with finding fresh food, if I'm experiencing challenges with the justice system, all of those things that are pressing on me that are eventually going to impact my health as well, if the doctor's not thinking about that, we have a problem.
Yeah, 100%. Yes, yes. How do you like deal with like the naysayers, people who think that there's no issues and like it doesn't matter who writes our policy, you know, it affects everyone. Everyone gets a fair shake and fair. You know, and fair. Us people, that's BS. You know, so how do you deal with that?
So I try my best to just remain civil, right? Usually I want to just like jump at folks like, what do you mean? Like it becomes really obvious and apparent when people are not exposed to these things. So I tend to go through like this routine of kind of creating a scenario for folks. Like I want to paint the picture for you. And it becomes like, you know, you think about yourself as an individual, you think about where you grew up. There's actually a website where I can type in my zip code and it's going to tell me my projected life expectancy.
Mm.
And then I can type in your zip code. And then I can start asking you about where you went to school. And I can think about some of the other opportunities that you may have been granted, just privilege that you're exposed to. And I can think of myself or people that look like me who weren't afforded those same opportunities and the challenges. I mean, I've done it at work where, you know, we're reviewing a candidate or we're putting together the like the interview panel. It's like, wow, look at all these white folks.
Yeah.
Like, there's no representation here. Or even in like our own administrations, there's not always people of color to sit on the panel. And that just starts to make you think and wonder and ask why. Well, there's a lack of diversity. And then people want to hit you with the, oh, you know, they're just not applying. They're not out there. Qualified candidates are, like, yeah, you full of shit. Like, and like yeah. You know, find the right pipeline if you're really looking.
Yeah.
And it's easier to just be like, oh, you know, we couldn't attract that kind of talent. So we're just going to hire Joe Blow. It's like, well, I mean, not that you could have just went to me and I would have gave you like 10,000 people, but if you have the people in the right spaces, they'll make it happen.
Yeah. 100%. Okay. So, like, I know, the hotbed topic right now is like, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter. And people like pushing back when you like try to have like, you know, affinity groups and you try to have like cultural specific things at places of employment. You know what I'm saying? Like, why are those things important?
I think everybody needs to have a safe space. I mean, a place where you feel like you are comfortable talking and raising issues. And also feel like in those safe spaces, there has to be an agreement that if we get to a point where we can't move this thing forward, we have to step outside of that too. And so I've been a part of affinity groups and organizations where, you know, groups have come up with like a list of demands, right? Like, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And I've seen how that doesn't go over well because you have those naysayers, you have those All Lives Matter people. But at the same time, keep doing it. Like, keep the same issues. Because the moment that you just give up is not going to go forward anyway. And yeah. That's what people want to see. They just want to see you burn out. And I've burnt out. Like, there's been times where I'm like, I can't do this anymore. But that's why you have an affinity group. Somebody else can pick up the mantle. Like, hey, I got you. You got to go ahead and push this piece of policy forward. Or no, we're about to change this thing because it's not working for our folks.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing just like being in different groups on Facebook, one thing that I have learned is that when there's people in your group that, so like any group that like there's a white person in the group, I hate to sound like this, but like there's so many groups where like, you know, I have groups like a group called Dead Portland Memories, you know, it is a group about like, you know, old things in Portland that aren't here anymore, group about like 80s wrestling and groups about a whole bunch of stuff. But because like there's a lot of like white people in these groups are racist. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like there's times where I just come to see like a post. And I look in the comments, and it's just like this crazy stuff going on in the comments. It's like, damn, like, you know, like this is supposed to be like a group for like fun and hobbies and activities. Now I gotta come and like deal with this shit. Like, I'm not safe anymore, you
know? Right?
And then there was another group that I joined. One of my Facebook friends that created, like, him and his brother, and it's a group about like people just like drinking. You know, like you posting your drinks, having fun, good time, mm-hmm. right? Now, you know, majority of this group is, I think, people of color, but there's, you know, some white people in the group. And there's two different times where there's, you know, there was one white person that came, didn't post a drink. He just posted a picture of his backyard with a Trump flag, you know. And then there was another post where this woman tried to come and, like, you know, show a picture of two beers and a Confederate flag and tried to explain, like, her not being racist. This flag means something different. It's like, so, like, when we let people in the group, y'all just want to just cause all kind of like disruption, you know what I'm saying? So like, and that was when I was like, this is why affinity group, like it took that to like, you know, like let me know, like, this is why affinity groups is important, you know, because, or even like if I was like, you know, I'm a, you know, like I'm a heterosexual man, you know what I'm saying? So like, if I went to, you know, like affinity group for like, you know, people that are, you know, like, you know, LGBTQ, I might say something that's harmful to them, and how am I going to come in their space and, you know, right. Put their vibe up. It's not right. You know what I'm saying?
Like, how you gonna come in my house and keep your shoes on?
You know what I'm saying? So like, and it just take those type of things to like, just like, see this is why we need people. Like, we gotta respect people's, you know, fuck our feelings. You know what I'm saying? Like, we gotta respect people's right to like go somewhere and not, you know, be harmed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, people deserve that.
I think I more recently I've been paying more attention to creating and having space like for people that look like me. And I can't think of the guy's name off the top of my head, but I know there's like the Black Men in Social Work page, which is like booming. Like every day I go there and like people have, you know, things that they're just like, you know, I got this upcoming event, or I'm facing this challenge, or I'm getting ready to move, or hey bro, can you just help me with this job prep? And I'm like, yeah, I need this kind of energy around me. Mm-hmm. Anybody that knows me, I'm the type that I just want to see my people win. Like, that's all I ever want. Like, bump me, I'm good, I'll be straight. But the people around me, I want to make sure that they have access to the things that I have access to.
For sure.
And there's been a few guys that have reached out, and, you know, I talked them through the interview process. Like, hey, I did CPS. Like, these are the things that you want to look out for.
Mm. Yeah. And I was one of those people. Not about CPS, though. Mm-mm. Not about that. But, you know, about...
I never do that again, though.
Yeah. About, you know, but how to transition from, you know, from being direct service person to somewhere who might be sitting in policy. I even interviewed with I did an information interview with a guy at my job. Shout out to Andre. He just got his doctorate. And he's a policy person at, you know, sits upstairs in the, you know, in the big house at work. So got some power. But he got his doctorate. I know you and grad school getting your doctorate. You know, like, why was that important? Or is it important?
Yeah, it's definitely important. And I think part of it for me, again, was about access. When I was at my last job, you know, I was a program director, but I didn't have a doctorate. And there were like one or two other people who didn't have doctors that were program directors. And I started to see the challenges with securing funds when you're writing for grants, but you don't have a PhD.
Mm.
For whatever reason, they're looking at you like you can't do the work. Like, I'm not sure what those three letters mean. Aside from that, I've gone to school for a while, and that's no disrespect to people with PhDs. I know you're highly intelligent. But at the same time, these organizations perpetuate the myth that because you don't have those degrees or those credentials, you can't do the work. Now, granted, I have been doing the work because I inherited it, so I had no choice. Mm-hmm. But to looking for new opportunities, it was a challenge.
Yeah.
So that is what prompted me to start looking at degrees in the first place. Like, I always knew I wanted to go back to school at some point. I didn't know if it was going to be a PhD or what it was going to be, but I always wanted to go back.
Yeah.
Because another thing that happens with that is it opens doors that are previously closed.
Mm.
You're into conversations that you weren't a part of before because now you're Dr. So-and-so.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, come sit with us because we're planning this. So, okay, bet. And for me, when it boiled down to it, I looked at the PhD in social work, and I looked at the doctor of social work. Research hasn't been my thing. Like, it just never has been. Like, I can get behind the idea of theory of change, behind, you know, statistics. I can get behind qualitative research. But it's not what I wanted to do. Like, my passion wasn't there. I knew I didn't want to be attached to an academic institution for the rest of my life working for them. And so that's why I took the path of doctor of social work. It was applied practice. It was taking the social problem, creating a design thinking framework around it, and how do you address it? And that's probably how I ended up at USC. Part of it is also the name. You have this prestige behind University of Southern California behind you.
Yeah.
Again, it's about doors and access. Like, oh, you went to USC. Like, okay, cool. And it was also because I didn't have to stop working. Because at this time, you know, I got a family. I got two kids. I got a wife. I got a mortgage. I got student loans. Me not working just wasn't really an option.
Yeah.
So it was able to fit what I needed at that time.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know that there was a difference between a doctor and a PhD. Like, that's something new to me.
Yep. So that doctor of social work is, it's definitely more practice driven. So it's for people who are in social work who want to take like the next level when it comes to practice. Like, I know the master's degree is the terminal degree, but again, it's about creating space for opportunity. When you have that doctor in front of your name, quite frankly, you get treated different.
Okay. What's a PhD? Like, you know, like, what kind of work is in a PhD program?
PhD is more on the research side of things. So that's typically training you to be a professor, to be more into, I guess because I didn't go, I don't know as well. So it's a philosophy. You are training to do research. You're typically going to be a professor or you're just going to be like a principal investigator somewhere. And again, I'm not saying this to like talk down on folks. It is, that is the trajectory of a PhD. A social worker is typically somebody who's working in a human service or human service type agency, and you need those credentials to move about.
Okay. But are you a doctor with both credentials?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So maybe that's
one is DS, which is mine.
Okay. So maybe that's why like I didn't like trip too much on like the differences, because I feel like, well, you're a doctor. So all right. How's the coursework?
The coursework has some rigor. So I'm typically between 2 and 3 courses per semester. I am officially in semester 4. I just came out of residency, which is the equivalent of, you know, having to defend your dissertation. And that was rough. That was my first semester with 3 classes, and I wanted to lose my mind, partially because of COVID. And so I've been at home, and we were supposed to be in California defending, so trying to arrange for like cancellation of flight, cancellation of hotel, while all still maintaining the integrity of the work was a challenge. But I am grateful to be on the other side now, and I should be wrapping up, fingers crossed, by May of next year.
Nice, super official. Yeah, you're gonna have to open some doors for me, brother.
Oh, you know it. You know, we open the doors everywhere.
You know, so you know, with the PhD and all those things like that, or you know, with the doctorate of social work, what are your like overall goals for, you know, you and your career?
It varies depending on the day. I think with the LLC right now, I just want to be like full time entrepreneur, but I'm afraid of like tax law, and I'm also afraid of insurance. The fact I don't know how that works when you don't have somebody else paying for it. I do want to spend some time more at a smaller college, like even just as an adjunct, because one of the things that I had an issue with when I was in grad school for my master's, I was learning from people who had never practiced. You know, these are people who went straight through and never, you know, had to deal with a client spitting at you or a client pulling the gun out at you. Like it's just things that you can't speak to. And I had an issue with that. So being able to be in those spaces, but I think I really, really want to spend a little bit of time in philanthropy. Like I really want to get a better sense of the grant making process. One, how we need to move away from this idea that philanthropy is for some reason saving community, because in many cases, it does is, like you mentioned, it's just a band-aid. It's to pacify. Like, we're not changing the systems. We're paying you to do a very specific project, and then you leave. The community still is experiencing these things that they were experiencing before. How about we actually broaden the conversation and really start addressing the isms that we talk about, and we start digging into some of those root causes? So I would love to spend some time, you know, disrupting philanthropy and foundations.
Yeah, okay. So, and I know I told my brother about that, and he was saying that, you know, how there's a lot of money in philanthropy now, which sounds kind of like contradictory, but you know, it kind of makes a little bit of sense, you know. But when you put it in that term, it's just business as usual. So if you don't see changes, it's just kind of like, oh, this is where we at, you know. So. You know, let's go to show up. Let's have a gala for the less fortunate. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Show up. We shake hands. I see other billionaires, millionaires, and we have a party. And then that's it.
Yeah. We're going to compare endowments, and we're just going to roll out. Like, I might write a $10,000 check for you to go try to, you know, expand services in this one community when we're not even addressing the issue. Like, it's just like, yeah. I think there has to be a better way to do grant making than what we have right now.
Yeah, gotta be. How you take care of yourself? All this work you do in COVID and doctor, student, and you know the state equity department, all this stuff, policy. How you take care of yourself?
That's something I still need to work on. I do like to write, like not for school. So just like poetry here and there. I do short stories here and there. I'm an avid reader, always have been. So when the semesters are like over, I usually have a list of books that I'm ready to like dive into. Yeah. Also, cook. So that's always been a thing that, you know, I can escape in the kitchen, throw in a little Anita Baker and just get to it.
Yeah. Okay. What'd you be cooking?
Man, whatever. Whatever. I know yesterday it was fried potatoes and sausage gravy because I feel like Saturdays are for like comfort food. Yeah. I can make whatever.
Okay. All right. Damn. I wish I had those kind of skills.
And I just got back into like watching documentaries and movies too. That's my other thing. Like I love movies anyway, but I love to like just sit down and immerse myself into film.
Okay. What kind of like, you said documentaries, like about what?
Usually it's social stuff, but there's a show on Vice, which I meant to text you and tell you to watch, about wrestling, like the dark side
of the ring. Oh, yeah, dark side of the ring.
Man, that should be deep, bro.
Yeah, I watched the one on New Jack.
Man, New Jack was a trip, bro.
I didn't even know who he was when I was a kid because I was straight WWF.
Okay.
But I didn't know who New Jack was, but yeah, he was wilding out. You know,
man, so we didn't have cable growing up, so ECW would just pop up on like random channels at nighttime.
Yeah,
we'd just see people just throwing chairs and blading and just all kinds of madness, but it was hype though.
Yeah, that's what's up. One thing you got to share before we get up out of here with the wonderful people, like any kind of, you know, any words of encouragement, any kind of advice, any personal statements, whatever.
All right, so I got a few things. So one, follow me on social media. I am at itsjb3. Two, if you ever need anything, even if I don't know you, if you are in social work, we know each other because we're working for a common cause. Like, just reach out. You know, I've looked at people's admission statements for colleges, like applying for their master's, that I don't know. Like, we've never crossed paths. But I just want to avail myself in that way, just to make sure that I see people around me doing what they want to do and not feel in any way that they can't. You know, I was talking to a young brother one day, and he was just like, you know, I don't know about applying for this MSW because of my GPA. I'm like, again, you are an African-American male. You are a rarity. You will stand out in any program. They need you. Apply, please. And also, I want people to understand their worth and value in social work. Because there's this myth that, you know, we do it for, because we have a helping heart, which we do, but it's not a matter of, I'm gonna work for pennies because I have a helping heart. Like, there was a table or a chart I saw the other day where they were talking about like the average salary for social workers. And I'm like, this is not okay. I realize that I've been blessed in many ways when it comes to salary. And I think part of that is because I'm not your traditional social worker. Like, I don't fit the therapist mold. But understanding that if I'm about to invest in myself with a master's, I'm not coming out of a master's degree to make $45,000 for the next 10 years. Like, there's no way. I don't care if I feel like I'm making a difference in people's lives every day. What about my own life? Like, what about my own cost of living? What about my own expenses? What about the things that I want to experience in life? I can't do that on $45,000. Mm-hmm. So understanding that if you've invested in yourself, know your worth. Know that when you get your degree, you don't have to stay in that one shitty job. And I think that social workers are some of the most dynamic professionals that there are. You can go anywhere. Like social work, you don't have to stay in a school. You don't have to stay in a hospital. You don't have to stay in the prisons. You can do all of those things. And I think that's where we limit ourselves because, oh, I'm a school social worker. Yeah, but how great would it be if a school social worker took those skills into a hospital setting, or if they took it into international relief? You know, being able to pick up those skills and transfer them, people are looking for us. Like, they are literally checking for social workers and the abilities that we bring. And you need to compensate us. Mm-hmm. Flat out. Like, I'm not, especially now, I'm acting different. You call me Dr. Bell, you better come with it.
Yeah. Yes, sir. I never thought about the international relief at that, but like, yeah, I remember reading the article, social workers are booming, like in areas like, yeah. Third world countries are, like Latino countries, things like that, because, people are making a difference. And I hope they're getting compensated.
Yeah. I wanted to do Peace Corps at a point in time, but there was a girl. So I was like, I'm going to stay home.
Yeah, I ain't mad at that. Well, sir, I appreciate you for joining me on this lovely afternoon. I know it's getting late over where you're at. So, we're going to stay in touch, bro. So,
Definitely. You cop anything lately?
Yes. So I think Wednesday, I'm gonna drop into this Zoom with these students. At the end of the month, me and another social worker in the area, Zadora, who was on the podcast a few weeks ago, we gonna do a lunch and learn type thing. That's a paid gig. I like that. And still on schedule to go to Alabama in September. So, I just started the second PowerPoint. So and it's about systematic oppression. So I'm gonna need some of your help, brother.
You know who to call, man.
Yes, sir. Well, man, I'm gonna see you in a minute.
All right, man. Appreciate you, bro.
Yes, sir.